I'd like to thank the organizers, well, everybody really very much for bringing me to this lovely part of the world and this conference. And I'd like to apologize to anybody who was at the Bonn meeting just over a year ago and came to California especially to hear this talk and find out what new I had to say, because in fact it's almost the same as I said in Bonn just over a year ago. I mean, we haven't been idle, but we've been all around the island looking for a better solution to the problem I'm going to talk to you about, and we haven't found anything. We came back, as happens in islands, to the place where we started from, and that was where I was at, tentatively, in Bonn just over a year ago. We is me and my longtime collaborator, Mirek Gersh, who's down here, and I'm going to be talking mainly about our attempts to model two specific galactic globular clusters, very nearby ones, M4 and NGC-6397. So this is almost the opposite of what Fred was trying to do. He was taking this lovely overview of the entire subject, whereas I'm going to burrow as far as I can into one specific task which he talked about. So I'll introduce these two objects briefly, just from a sort of photogenic point of view. I'll talk a little bit about how one attempts to model individual objects and their dynamical evolution. And the interesting thing about comparing these two objects is their surface brightness profiles. So I'm going to be focusing a lot on that. And in the second part of my talk, I'll be concentrating on a number of mechanisms, which were largely, in fact, all mentioned, I think, by Fred, which are responsible, we might think, for shaping the surface brightness profile. And these are the various traditional ones, and more or less exotic, and more recent ones. So here they are, M4 and 6397. They are pretty well the two most nearby galactic globular clusters, and I'm afraid as a theorist I've seen neither of these objects, not even in a pair of binoculars. But we shouldn't ignore the photogenic appeal of these objects. Bob Strobe, an old friend of mine, who was largely responsible for setting up the South Africa Large Telescope, he once told me that shortly after the multiracial government was established in South Africa, he had a visitation, a high-powered visitation from the government at night at his observatory, and he showed them a globular cluster. And 6 weeks later, the government announced a massive increase in the funding for fundamental research, including astronomy. And Bob always attributed this to the photogenic appeal of these objects. Now, modeling them from a theoretical point of view gets divided up into two basic types. I mean, there are sort of static models, exemplified by the long-running models of Ivan King and its various derivatives. And for a sort of non-stereodynamic audience, I would characterize these as being something like generalized isothermal models for a star. And these are very good workhorses after 40 or more years for answering many problems in dynamics of star clusters. But perhaps more recently, there's been an increasing emphasis on the rather harder job of doing a sort of evolutionary model, which allows you, in principle, to relate what one can see at the present day to what these objects might have looked like a long time ago. And I suppose there are two methods of choice for trying to do this. There are N-body models, which Fred already referred to, but the globular clusters, certainly at one time, most of them still are too big for doing this kind of thing, but this may be possible in the next year or two. And in the meantime, one or two groups around the world are using a slightly more simplified approach, which is the Monte Carlo approach, which some people might object to this, but I would say they provide a similar kind of level of detail as n-body models, but they do involve larger numbers of assumptions and simplifications. But they can cope with clusters which are as big as the globular clusters, even 12 giga-years ago. Now, the first kind of modeling, here's Ivan himself showing you how to apply King models to a star cluster. Everybody, I hope, has seen this picture. So this is essentially one parameter family of shapes of surface brightness profiles from Ivan's models. And these have been all normalized to a single central surface brightness and a single core radius. That gives you two more scale parameters, and you have a three parameter family of models, basically, to fit to your data. And then there are multi-mass and anisotropic variants of this, which are the stock and trade of doing this kind of thing. And if you apply that kind of technique to these two clusters which I'm talking about, you find something rather different. M4 is well fitted by a single mass King model, I think, certainly by a multi-mass one. It's got this well-resolved core radius and a relatively flat area of surface brightness, even from the ground, as in this Traeger et al. Compilation back in 1995. So that's a fairly typical King profile cluster, and about 80% or so of the galactic globular clusters could be classified as King cluster. 6397, on the other hand, this twin of M4, is rather different. The surface brightness seems to continue to increase in towards the center, even from the ground, and more recent data indicates that there's actually a shallow cusp very close to the center of NGC 6397. I'll be giving you a closer look at that data in just a few minutes. But basically, this can't be fitted by a single mass King profile. And one might summarize a wee bit of a complicated history by saying that it's got an unresolvable core, and certainly it has a brighter central surface brightness than M4 has, allowing for the various differences. Now, what Mirek and I have been doing over the last couple of years or so is to try and do one of these dynamical evolutionary models of each of these clusters. M4 I talked about in Capri over a year ago, and we published that last year. 6397, as I say, I was beginning to work on this at the end of 2007. And we've worked harder on it throughout 2008. And I've just last month submitted a paper on our modeling of that cluster. And I put it up on the archive, even though it's not been refereed yet. Don't usually like to do this, but just to make it visible for this conference, I put it up there last week. And what we've done is to try and construct models starting from year zero, as it were, evolve dynamically with Monte Carlo approximations of the dynamics of single stars and binaries and synthetic stellar and binary evolution and so on, evolve that for 12 giga-years, have a look at our model, and try and adjust what we call initial conditions so that at the present day one gets a fit to the basic data, basically. Surface brightness profile, which is the most important thing I'm going to talk about, and I'll show you that for 6397 in just a minute, the velocity dispersion profile, luminosity function, one of the great constraints in this kind of thing in the last decade or so, and the observed binary fraction, as well as we might think we know it. I mean, this is not a terribly easy task, by the way. One has to go backwards and forwards, keep adjusting the initial conditions until one gets this approximately right. And I do say approximately, reasonably satisfactory is how I might describe it at best. Each of these models, by the way, takes about a day or two with the Monte Carlo code. 6397 is just a wee bit harder than M4. So here is the surface brightness profile of 6397. This is, you can't imagine how much difficulty it causes me to turn the results in n-body units into v-magnitudes per square arc second. and having done it once, I never changed the formula, and it continues to work. Okay, so this data here, the green pluses and so on, is all of the Traeger et al. Compilation. This blue stuff here is from Noyola and Gebhardt, that's HST stuff. And this red curve here is the wobbly result of what we regard as our most satisfactory model. And there might very well be a little bit of controversy about it. I mean, observe that our model is a little bit small. There's a good reason for that. It's a technical feature of the way we do the tidal truncation, just to try and make the model lose mass at the correct rate. It means that we have to impose a slightly too small radius. The model, the red curve here, is overall slightly dim, I think. It's obviously subject to some fluctuations from individual bright stars. But even if you ignore this innermost few stars, of which there are two bright ones with peaks just here, what one would readily say, I think, is that this is a model which could not be fitted by a single mass King model. This really is a decent model of a non-King globular cluster, even if one might argue about the overall brightness and what's happening in the center here. So this is, oh, by the way, I should explain why there are these little features here in the Monte Carlo model, surface brightness profile. The Monte Carlo model gives you a radius for each star. And we construct this surface brightness by assuming that each spherical shell corresponding to the radius of a star is giving out light at a uniform rate over the surface of the shell. And at the edges of the shell, where you have a projection of the edge of the shell, the surface brightness is actually infinite. And that gives rise to these occasional peaks. I mean, we could, in principle, turn the Monte Carlo model into a snapshot, which we could observe by the observer's techniques. But on the other hand, there are three or four different techniques which go into all of this data. And it's a question of which one would want to choose. So let's have a look at the comparison between these two objects. Because for a long time, it's been clear that this is a test case of our understanding of the kind of issues which Fred was talking about. These objects are so similar in almost every respect except their surface brightness profile. And that's the puzzle. OK, the distance from the sun, that's kind of irrelevant to this, except that both objects are well resolved. Distance to the galactic center, which to some extent determines the timescale of their evolution. That's very similar. I'll talk a bit more about that in detail later. Their mass is very, very similar. The half-light radii, ditto. The tidal radii, looking not quite so similar, in fact, probably more similar than these numbers appear. These are Harris et al. Numbers, and anybody who's done this will know that the tidal radii are quite hard to determine empirically. The binary fractions, this is from the UBC group, and I'll talk a little bit more about that again. I mean, I think there's a fair amount of discrepancy in estimates of binary fractions from different groups, and it was more important for this purpose to have a kind of uniform assessment in two clusters rather than to do a comprehensive comparison. The one other difference between these clusters, which is very noticeable, is their metallicity. And a long time ago, there was a suggestion that non-King clusters were slightly more prevalent in low metallicity clusters than in high metallicity clusters, but it was rather indicative rather than statistically significant. And the overall picture one has from this is that these two clusters are very similar, except for the surface brightness profile. And so one has to try and understand how two twins end up looking relatively different as far as the surface brightness profile is concerned. And so I'm going to go through a number of mechanisms which are thought to affect the surface brightness profile and see to what extent these can account for the king shape of M4 and the non-king shape of 6397. Core collapse, tidal effects, primordial binaries, stellar mass black holes, intermediate mass black holes. By the way, I'm a conservative kind of guy, and so I put this one here with a fair amount of trepidation. First hypothesis, which one might call the standard explanation, to the extent that one often hears clusters divided between king clusters and collapse core clusters, as if it was obvious that the highly concentrated cuspy ones were collapsed and the other ones were uncollapsed. I think it was Giampaolo who actually corrected me in this and said, no, it's king clusters and non-king clusters. And that was a good step in the right direction. Roughly speaking, the time scale of core collapse goes as certainly the initial kind of relaxation time, complicated because of mass loss and expansion of clusters. At the present time, which is not necessarily a guide to the core collapse time, M4 is evolving slightly faster than 6397. And so if you took this argument naively, you would say that M4 is evolving faster and should go into core collapse sooner, but it's the one with the uncollapsed profile. So you already get an indication that it's hard to account for the difference in the surface brightness profiles by the core collapse mechanism. And in fact, that was one of the most interesting things that we found when we started to model these clusters with the Monte Carlo technique. So here is a rather busy sort of diagram showing you in parsecs, I didn't do the translation from n-body units here to this extent. So this is the core radius of these two objects as a function of time. So this is 0 GeV, this is 12 GeV at the present time. This purple stuff is NGC 6397, which we think core collapsed a little sooner than M4. M4 is this blue crosses, but it did core collapse, we think, according to the model, about 4 GeV ago. And I mean, this was a bit of a surprise to us because we'd grown up with the thinking of M4 as an uncollapsed cluster, but there it seemed to be the obvious conclusion that M4 was a collapsed core cluster despite having a king surface brightness profile. So this confirms the impression one gets from the relaxation time that core collapse is not the issue in explaining the surface brightness profile. Now, a long time ago, Lyman Spitzer observed that tidal effects could affect the timescale of core collapse, and that if something was buffeted substantially by tides, then it would core collapse a little bit sooner than one which was in a relatively mild tide, unless the tidal effects were really vigorous. But when you look at the orbits of these two objects, to the extent that one knows these things, actually it's M4 which has the more vigorous tidal shocking than 6397. These are independent estimates of apocenter and pericenter for 6397. Here I've given you from one source, peri and apocenter. This is in kiloparsecs for M4. And it's clear, as I said, that 6397 is somewhat more mildly tidally affected than M4. So if vigorous tides again accelerate core collapse, it really doesn't help you to understand why M4 is the one with the so-called uncollapsed profile, whereas 6397 has the cusp. Then there's the primordial binaries. Now, as Fred said in his introductory talk, primordial binaries are a heating source, and once things settle down, you would expect a core to have expanded as a result of binary heating. And then one can ask the question, well, maybe it's some difference in the binary populations which explains the difference in the surface brightness profile. And here, I've again rather uniformly used the UBC information on the binary fractions, which I've summarized a little bit in these round numbers here. And although, as I say, other people have obtained estimates for these things, they're generally speaking somewhat different. And just for uniformity of approach, as it were, I've tried to use the same source for both objects. But anyway, the bottom line is that one sees that in 6397, if anything, one has a larger primordial binary fraction than in M4. And so if you thought that primordial heating was doing the job, then it's 6397 which should have the flat large core and not M4. So again, primordial binaries don't seem to be helping. Then there's something which, again, Fred referred to, which is the effect of stellar mass black holes formed by normal processes of stellar evolution, which basically sinking to the center of a young cluster push the rest of the stars out by mass segregation. And that process, I'm sure, does work early on in our models of these two clusters, but it's more or less stopped by now. This picture here shows the number of black holes in our models as a function of time. This green line here is 6397, the red line is M4, and basically we predict no black holes, possibly one, I think, in M4. This stops at one at the present day. And although one could expect possibly a residual effect of this old dead population of black holes on the present day core radius, that's not what the models show. The black holes have been ejected and the core has settled down to some new kind of equilibrium. So again, I don't think stellar mass black holes help. Finally, on the sort of sensible hypotheses, as it were, there's intermediate mass black holes. I don't think anybody, I couldn't find anybody in the literature who'd ever suggested that M4 has an intermediate mass black hole at its center. And I hesitated to even link the two words together in case ADS would henceforth forever pick this up and think that I had suggested that M4 had an intermediate mass black hole at the center. Far from it. I could find no literature, and as far as 6397 was concerned, all I found was this upper limit here, based on the usual kind of assumptions about what you get from accretion onto a single black hole. All right, okay, fine. Yeah, good. So one's left with this problem: if nothing works, what does? And we ended up with this hypothesis, which I still almost regard as a working hypothesis, which is that it's fluctuations. Here's the surface brightness of various models of 6397. There's the one I showed you. And the green and the blue here at the center, somewhat dimmer, are the same model half a giga year and one giga year ago. In other words, dimmer at the center. Here is a model starting off with a different seed, but at 12 giga year, also dimmer at the center. Very, very faint down at the bottom here, plotted with the same assumptions about extinction and so on, is M4, almost within the range of the surface brightness profiles that one sees from these models. In other words, our conclusion is we think that it's fluctuations in the models in time which are responsible for whether the surface brightness profile is king or non-king. Now, like me, you may be thinking that a Monte Carlo model is not the way to try and study fluctuations. Nobody's really looked at fluctuations in the Monte Carlo model. So what we did, and just 2 or 3 weeks ago we started this, was to construct an n-body model of 6397 at the present day from the Monte Carlo model. And we've started evolving this. It's the biggest n-body simulation I've done. It really rather stretches my resources, but we've been coaxing it along for 2 or 3 weeks now, and it's covered a quarter of a giga year. And we're going to carry on for another month, and once we've done that, we'll have a picture of one giga year in the life of NGC 6397. with apologies to Solzhenitsyn. And the interesting thing is the fluctuations which one sees. This is the 1% Lagrangian radius on a variety of timescales, much, much, much longer than the crossing time of the core. These are effects of relaxation, individual binary events, and so on, but this is with a population of primordial binaries. Now, these fluctuations may not look like much, but it's 20% in the radius containing 1% of the mass of the cluster. And that means that the innermost 1% of the mass has got a mean density, which is varying by a factor of 2, over timescales of a few hundred million years. Now, the one thing we haven't done yet is to turn all of this n-body stuff, this really is n-body units now, into variations in the surface brightness profile. This was a bit of an afterthought. We only started picking up that data from the model at about 200 million years, and it's too early to conclude what the result is. But this is my conclusion, and it's the one which is in this submitted paper on 6397, that the difference between these two clusters is essentially a fluctuation. And I'd like to say that these fluctuations are not simply due to individual bright stars going in and out of a kind of fixed core. This is a kind of collective gravithermal effect. It's not full-blown gravithermal oscillations, but it's on the edge of that. And the other conclusion we have from this work, somewhat depressing conclusion that Fred also referred to, is that this is not a deterministic problem that we're trying to solve. Thank you.
Questions? If you're farther in the back, if you could grab the mic, that's right near the projector.
So I noticed in your plot of the core radius as a function of time that the initial density is about a factor of 100, maybe 1,000 greater than at the present day. And I noticed in your paper you mentioned that you didn't see any evidence of a runaway collision scenario.
That's right. Yeah.
But isn't it true that your binary interactions are from recipes and you wouldn't have collisions in the binary interactions?
We wouldn't have them in the binaries, actually, that's true.
Okay.
We would certainly have them in the single-single.
But what's driving the expansion at early times is binary interactions. Is
that right? What's driving the expansion at early times is three things, I think. It's stellar evolution mass loss, mm-hmm. it's black holes, and it's binary heating. All three things are active.
You mentioned that the binary fractions go the wrong way, right? So, and you say you rule out them because the in 6 around 7 is actually higher measured today. I just wondered, can you rule out? I mean, couldn't it be that the binaries you observe today, since it's today's binary fraction, you know, couldn't they have been formed precisely because 6397 is in fact denser today? So, couldn't it be the interactions themselves that enhance the present day binary fraction? And so, you're not really comparing the right quantity.
Yeah. Actually, it's a hard one to answer that, actually. We don't actually carefully keep track of what kind of binaries we have in the model at each time. And I was discussing this with Sverre because I was asking him the same question about the n-body simulations. Because what I was finding in that n-body model here was that half of the binary heating was coming from things which n-body 6 was telling me were new binaries, and half of it was coming from the primordial binaries. And that rather surprised me, although I think Simon once said to me that he thought that primordial binaries were important for these kinds of things. But when one looks at it carefully, n-body 6 does the following thing. If a primordial binary exchanges with a single star, that's still regarded as a primordial binary. If two primordial binaries collide, leaving a hierarchical triple, which is very common, that outer star in the hierarchical triple is regarded as forming a new binary. And this may very well be actually what we're seeing as new binaries. So I'm afraid I can't very readily answer that question. It is a bit fraught, unfortunately.
Maybe you've done this already, but it would be very interesting to see some on-off comparisons in getting a sense of, you know, what is important and what is not. For example, what if you had no binaries and you redid the exact same thing? Would that matter a lot?
That's what happens with no binaries. pilot run, what we did was to take our model and make the binaries inert. And this was fantastic, actually. I mean, you got this deep core collapse here. This is a linear scale, so this is really almost zero here. And then there was one binary event, et cetera, et cetera. So it's clear that... I'm sorry, this is the 1% Lagrangian radius, this is the core radius. This is all without binaries. Or should I say inert binaries? So in a sense, there's a few percent of somewhat heavier stars in this one. We were initially thinking that, well, the primordial binaries are in such a small abundance here that they're not going to matter. But they do matter. They actually prevent this very, very deep collapse here and suppress the amplitude of these fluctuations.
I don't know, you think that deep collapse is not even a factor of 2 in core radius?
This one?
Oh, I'm sorry, it's a factor of 2.
I think so, yeah.
A naive question. These are rather low-mass clusters. What would happen if the mass were higher? Would you still see these kinds of effects?
I don't know, I'm afraid. It's a good question, and I'd like to try someday.
So I was just saying, I understand that the core relaxation time is very similar and short for both clusters, but let me ask you a provocative question also for the Modest 9 discussion. What about if the initial conditions are really very different, in the sense that I don't think we can say in any way that 6397 hosts more than one stellar population, as far as I know. But we 6397 very likely is just a single population cluster. It's the prototype of a single population cluster. Okay. In M4, we have now evidence that there are two populations.
That's tough.
It's provocative.
Back to the drawing board, or another paper, should I say?
I think what John Paul is saying is the different metallicity populations, right? Right. It doesn't seem to me like this is a killer for understanding your work, because if they're different by a billion years, it's probably not going to... It could affect the initial conditions, I think, is the most important thing.
Yeah.
Just a corollary, are your recipes for stellar evolution metallicity dependent?
Yes.
And do you see that at some explicit level in the comparisons?
I don't suppose we've looked, actually. Everything else is different between the two clusters as well as the metallicities.
If that was a significant difference, perhaps we might want to look at that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's the one thing where we didn't do our comparison of changing just one thing at a time.
Yeah. Are your changes to be thought of as truly statistical in the same sense as rolls of dice? And are we to forget about the scenarios of barothermal oscillations at the center and of binaries self-ejecting so that you need new binaries to keep the evolution going?
Well, there are several questions in what you were asking, Ivan. And even if these were full-blown gravithermal oscillations, they could very well be chaotic. And so it's stochasticity of the kind which is generated in many examples of deterministic phenomena. As for the individual binary events and so on, as I hinted in my reply to Fred, it's a less stochastic kind of energy input when you have a large population or even a small population of primordial binaries than if you have to wait for the binaries to form. That's much more stochastic.